Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. The Minister's been caught up in engagement, so I'll be very brief with my introduction. Josh Frydenberg makes a very welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been a long time friend and supporter of the Institute, and it's great to have him back in this very important role that he currently has. So I'll introduce him very briefly. As you know, the member for Kooyong in Melbourne, the Minister for Environment and Energy. He had a number of important positions in the Abbott and now the Turnbull government. And the topic for tonight is ensuring energy security and affordability as we transition to a lower emissions future. Mr. Frydenberg, you're very welcome. Thank you.
As we transition to a lower emission future, that was a Freudian slip. As we distribution, retail, generate to a lower transmission emissions future. Well, firstly, thank you, Gerard and Anne, for having me back here. And lovely to see so many familiar faces. The Sydney Institute is a wonderful organisation, a forum for the exchange of ideas, for the battle of ideas. And it's been a great privilege to be here a number of times. And a little birdie told me that Gerard had given up an offer to be on that right-wing show this tonight, the Q&A, in order to, you know, to be here with us. So I feel very privileged. Thanks, Gerard. But I was speaking to one of your fellow panellists just before, George Brandis. So I'm sure he'll do sound arguments and he'll do us all proud there tonight. So thank you again, and I look forward to speaking to you about what is an extremely challenging time in Australia's energy markets. The national electricity market connects a power system that is more than 5,000 kilometres long, spanning from Port Douglas in North Queensland to Port Lincoln in South Australia, across the Bass Strait to Tasmania. It's the longest interconnected power system in the world. As the chief scientist, Alan Finkel, has observed, we are currently undergoing a once-in-a-century transformation, akin to the telecommunications sector, going from a landline to a mobile. It's the biggest change in the electricity system since the 1800s, when Nikola Tesla beat out Thomas Edison in what was known as the AC-DC wars, or the War of the Currents, which led to electricity being supplied to the grid by central generators. Driven by changing consumer preferences and technological advances, we are now moving to a more distributed energy system, one that includes more intermittent sources of generation. All this is occurring in a complex energy market with shared federal and state responsibilities managed under the auspices of the COAG Energy Council, which I chair. Tonight, I want to make three points. First, the need to maintain baseload generation so that our households and businesses continue to enjoy a secure and reliable supply of energy. Second, the importance of reducing pressure on electricity prices so that Australian consumers who are already struggling do not face unnecessary price increases. Third, our strong record in meeting our emissions reductions targets and doing so in a way that doesn't undermine energy security and energy affordability. In transitioning to a lower emissions future, the Prime Minister has been clear that Australia should achieve that trifecta of affordable, reliable and secure energy, and that the only way to do so is to be technology neutral. Let me start by commenting on some recent events. South Australia has been struck by a series of price spikes and outages. The statewide blackout in South Australia on the 28th of September last year was a wake-up call to the nation. It was the first time an entire state lost power. We saw gridlock on the roads, people stuck in lifts, 1.7 million people in the dark, and it was estimated to cost more than $350 million, let alone the impact on future investment in that state. Three more blackouts have followed in December, in January, and in February. These events show the vulnerability of a jurisdiction that relies too heavily on intermittent sources of generation such as wind and solar, without the necessary storage and backup support. On average, 41% of electricity generation in South Australia comes from wind and solar. It is among the highest penetration on a per capita basis of intermittent power anywhere in the world. The challenge is that the quantity of generation varies so graphically. From supplying less than 1% of South Australia's demand in 1 month to providing 80% of South Australia's demand in another month. When the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, power is simply not being generated. This means the days of forecastable supply are over. Nowhere was this more clear than during the last South Australian blackout, when 90,000 consumers lost power. It is a telling case study. At 6:30 p.m. on the 8th of February, just before the load shedding, thermal generation, namely gas, was supplying 68% of the state's electricity, operating at 81% capacity, near its highest point for the day. Wind generation was supplying only 3% of electricity, operating at 6% of capacity and near its lowest point of the day. This was 50% lower than the forecast 2 hours earlier and 90% lower from the highest point earlier that day. Solar generation was supplying 5% of electricity, operating at 22% of its capacity, less than a third of the peak from earlier that day. Interconnectors from Victoria, ironically providing brown coal-fired power from the Latrobe Valley, were supplying the balance of power into South Australia at 24%, and they were operating at 93% capacity. The impending closure of Hazelwood in Victoria will present additional challenges for South Australia, Victoria, and the rest of the national electricity market. Hazelwood has supplied 22% of Victoria's electricity demand in 2015 and 14% of South Australia's consumption in 2015-16. When Hazelwood closes, AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Operator, forecasts Victoria will go from being an exporter to an importer of power during times of peak demand, and the imports will come from New South Wales, black coal-fired power. Since the closure of Port Augusta's northern coal-fired power station last year, South Australia has doubled its reliance on Victoria, which now provides a quarter of its needs. 10 coal-fired power stations have closed in Australia since 2001, and Hazelwood is the 11th. As the generation mix changes, there is also a vital need for new frequency control and ancillary services to help stabilise the grid. Historically provided by baseload coal generators, these services have been taken for granted, and new markets will need to be created by a higher uptake of wind and solar. This is why we need to have an all-of-the-above approach to new technologies, with the goal of providing sufficient baseload power to help maintain energy security. We should not simply dismiss the new technologies that can maintain coal and gas as a key part of our energy mix, while at the same time substantially reducing emissions. As the Prime Minister has said, Australia is the largest exporter of coal in the world, and we have invested $590 million since 2009 in carbon capture and storage technology and research. Yet we do not have one high-efficiency, low-emission coal-fired generator, let alone one with carbon capture and storage. It has to be said that these are not experimental technologies. As Australia's chief scientist, Dr. Alan Finkel, has said, existing coal and new coal with CCS is a very legitimate low-emissions technology. Healy, these high-efficiency, low-emission coal-fired generators, can reduce emissions by up to 40% by using additional heat to create greater efficiencies. And they're being deployed around the world in countries such as Germany, which have a higher emissions reduction target than Australia, where a new plant is destined to come online next year. And Japan, where 45 of these new plants are in train. And they're doing so, these countries, in order to meet the twin objectives of reducing emissions and ensuring energy security. Across East Asia, there are already 725 of these Healy coal-fired generators, with more than 1,000 in the planning. Even in Europe, there is 8 gigawatts of ultra-supercritical coal capacity being built in the next 5 years. Encouragingly, research into CCS released by the University of Queensland just last week shows that today 15 large-scale CCS projects are in operation, storing 28 megatons of carbon per year, and by the end of this year there will be 22 large-scale projects storing 40 megatons. Here in Australia, the Gorgon LNG project in Western Australia will have the capacity to store up to 4 million tonnes of carbon each year, leading to a 40% reduction in emissions. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the International Energy Agency have repeatedly warned that CCS will need to play a critical role if the world is to meet its emissions reduction targets. At the same time, the IEA has estimated that CCS could reduce the cost of electricity sector decarbonisation by around $3.5 trillion between 2012 and 2035. The importance of baseload power has been acknowledged by Dr. Finkel in his preliminary report to the COAG Energy Council on the future security of the national electricity market, where he noted that there are security and reliability issues resulting from an increased penetration of renewables into the grid. The final report, due out in the first half of this year, will set out a long-term national reform blueprint for the security, reliability and affordability of the NEM. He has already identified several proof-of-concept projects to help address this challenge. Projects to be fast-tracked include synchronous condensers, synthetic inertia, and power conversion systems. Higher penetration of renewable technologies is simply not possible without storage to balance their intermittent nature. And that is why the government is investing heavily in storage technologies, with over $220 million committed to date. In the Prime Minister's National Press Club speech just a couple of weeks ago, he announced ARENA and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation had formally commenced a funding round to support demonstration-scale projects with an initial commitment of $20 million. This includes support for flexible capacity and large-scale storage technologies like batteries, pumped hydro, concentrated solar thermal, biomass, and demand management technology. Storage technologies are already helping to smooth out solar generation and reduce the evening peak. At least 6,750 battery storage systems were installed across the country last year, and some are predicting that this figure will triple this year to more than 20,000. In August, AGL, in partnership with ARENA, announced the launch of the world's largest virtual power plant in South Australia, and this project will link 1,000 household battery systems together, allowing peak demand to be met by stored, pooled energy from rooftop solar systems. We're unapologetic that our number one goal when it comes to energy policy is energy security. Recent events are not, as Labor's energy spokesman Mark Butler has called them, simply hiccups. The challenges in South Australia are real and they're serious, and we don't want to see them repeated across the country. As the energy market operator has noted, the growing proportion of this type of generating plant within the generation portfolio is leading to more periods with low inertia and low available fault levels, hence lower resistance to extreme events. Our political opponents are looking for scapegoats rather than confronting the very real problems facing the South Australian electricity system. They want to blame a storm. They want to blame the market operator. They want to muddy the issue by conflating the events in South Australia and in New South Wales. But it's now clear to all Australians, particularly South Australians, that the Weatherill government's self-described big experiment has failed, and that better planning should have been in place to prepare for the impact that a high uptake of intermittent sources of generation would have. It's not only energy security that has been compromised in South Australia's big experiment. We have also seen significant price rises in that state. South Australian consumers now face the highest prices in the national electricity market, about 50% above the average. When the Northern Power Station closed in South Australia last May, contract prices in the state jumped. Consider large industrial users in South Australia looking to limit their exposure to volatile wholesale prices. In June 2015, a contract covering supply in the first quarter of 2017 cost about $62. But by June 2016, within weeks of Northern's closure, the same contract cost about $93. That's a 50% increase. For those who instead chose to rely on the spot market, about 2 months later, after Northern closed, the average wholesale price in South Australia had increased from $50 to $163 per megawatt hour. That's an increase of more than 200%. As a result of Hazelwood's closure, the AEMC forecasts wholesale electricity costs will increase by around 35% for Victoria, South Australia and Tasmania in 2017-18. Households are also under pressure. The average household bill in Australia in 2018-19 will increase by $78. For Victorians will increase by $99 and for South Australians by $150. Here in New South Wales, it will increase by $74 as a result of the closure of Hazelwood. During the Labor Party's last 6 years in office, electricity prices went up by 101%. The Coalition's repeal of the carbon tax led to the largest price fall on record, according to the ABS. Nevertheless, household electricity prices in Australia are now the seventh highest in the OECD on a market exchange rate basis and the 22nd highest on a purchasing power parity basis. And now the Labor Party, at both state and federal level, want to see a renewable energy target of 50% by 2030. Even the CFMEU national president wrote to Labor MPs telling them, and I quote, an increased renewable energy target of 50% by 2030 will increase the cost of electricity for manufacturing and ordinary households, while being a poor tool to reduce Australia's overall global warming emissions. That is why the Prime Minister and I have been putting pressure on the Shorten opposition to tell the Australian people exactly what their target would cost and how they think they're going to reach it. Despite the occasional admission that their target would cost around $48 billion or require around $48 billion in investment, ultimately to be recouped from consumers, confusion still reigns about what Labor really does have. Does it have an ambition, an aspiration, a goal, or in fact a target, let alone whether it will be legislated? In contrast, as the government, we've been upfront about the impact and the cost of our 23.5% renewable energy target, which the AEMC, the Australian Energy Market Commission, has said will add $63 to an average annual household energy bill. It's against this backdrop that we are pursuing a number of reforms to reduce power pressure on power prices. The COAG Energy Council has agreed to significant reforms to stop energy businesses gaming the system by appealing how much they can recoup from customers. These significant reforms are important as network costs make up around 50% of household energy bills. Under the new regime, network businesses would no longer be able to appeal certain decisions of the Australian Energy Regulator through the limited merits review process. In the current round of appeals, network businesses sought to add $7.3 billion to energy bills by using this appeal process. In New South Wales, a current appeal is putting at risk a reduction of up to $300 on household energy bills in this state, simply because of this appeal mechanism. And so COAG, and I've led this reform from the start, is committed to delivering this important change within the first half of this year. Lowering energy costs will also require more gas supplies and more gas suppliers into the market. The growth in gas production for LNG export, coupled with high exploration and development costs, has actually put pressure on domestic gas prices. When a $9 per gigajoule wholesale gas price translates into $100 a megawatt hour electricity price, sustained high gas prices make it extremely difficult for gas to fill its role as a transition fuel that is affordable to customers. The government is working to reduce the costs across the supply chain by reforming gas markets to make price of gas more affordable. Last year, our Energy Council commissioned Dr. Michael Vertigan to investigate the bargaining relationship around the transport of gas. His report found that there is an uneven bargaining relationship in the transportation of gas, with transportation accounting for 15% of the price of gas. Again, at our COAG meeting on Friday, ministers agreed on the introduction of national legislation that will lower costs by mandating greater disclosure and transparency for pipeline services and pricing. And we've also agreed that there should be mandatory commercial arbitration in the regulated gas pipeline sector. These are very important reforms that will put downward pressure on electricity and gas prices. The government is also targeting energy productivity to help reduce energy costs and emissions across the economy. Our National Energy Productivity Plan will improve energy productivity by 40% by 2030. And as part of this Commonwealth's expansion of the Commercial Building Disclosure Program, will actually save $50 million in new energy savings and more than 3 million tonnes of emissions. We're also pursuing a range of energy savings initiatives around appliances, lighting and vehicles, with lighting efficiency enhancements alone having the potential to save households $2,400 over the next decade. When it comes finally to emissions reduction, it's not often appreciated that Australia's emissions per capita and on a GDP basis are at the lowest in 27 years. I'll repeat that. Our emissions intensity as an economy on a per capita and a GDP basis are the lowest in 27 years. This is despite Australia enjoying one of the highest rates of population growth and the longest periods of economic growth among advanced economies. Australia has also had a strong track record in meeting its international emissions reduction target. We beat our first Kyoto target by 128 million tonnes, and we're on track to beat our 2020 target by 224 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent. We made a strong pledge in Paris, and we are committed to reducing our emissions by 26 to 28% by 2030 on 2005 levels. This means, and the method of achieving this goal will be vitally important. We must place a premium on the reliability and the affordability of this system as we transition. That is why we have a strong suite of policies, such as the Emissions Reduction Fund, the 2020 Renewable Energy Target, the National Energy Productivity Plan, and the phasing down of hydrofluorocarbons. Incredibly, the international effort on HFCs is estimated to achieve up to 72 billion tonnes in CO2 equivalent emission savings by 2050. This is roughly 1.3 times the world's total emissions. We are also conducting a review this year of our climate change policies, and this review will help us ensure that we're on track to meet our 2030 target, a task that has been halved based on the most recent projections. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, in order to maintain energy security during the transition to a lower emissions future, we need to keep baseload power in the system. We can ill afford the myopic ideological approach which preferences one set of technologies over another and which will lead to higher prices and instability. The government is committed to a truly national reform agenda for Australia's energy markets, reforms which prioritise stabilising our system. We're already taking steps to do so, maintaining energy security with the important Finkel review now underway, putting downward pressure on prices by reforming gas markets and network regulation, and adopting a technology-neutral approach to emissions reduction, which will ensure that energy security is not jeopardised. It's a complex and challenging area, but one that is absolutely vital for Australia's future economic prosperity. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Minister. So we come to questions and discussion. We don't have a microphone up here, so if I think your voice is not getting picked up in the microphone, I'll repeat it, although we may get a microphone. I'll repeat your question or your comment. Firstly, thanks to King & Wood Mallesons for the use of this great facility tonight, and we're very grateful for that. And so, kick off. I grew up in the great federal seat of Kuyo. In the Menzies years, in the 50s and the 60s, and I'm very conscious how the prosperity of people in Victoria and the rest of Australia was very much driven by good government, but also access to cheap and reliable energy. In Victoria it was brown coal, and elsewhere it was black coal. To what extent do you think the Australian public is going to be willing to wear ever-increasing energy prices? I mean, you've got a target of 23.5%, Labor's got a target of 50%. Do you think the Australian public is going to be willing to wear this kind of increased level as we move to embrace the Paris Agreement, or do you think there's going to be some kind of uprising or peaceful revolt against ever-increasing electricity prices?
Well, thanks, Gerard, and you're absolutely right about Victoria, because it was Sir John Monash who played that important role after the First World War, bringing back the technology that he'd picked up from Germany about how to generate electricity from the wonderful coal reserves that Victoria had in the Latrobe Valley. And that underpinned that state becoming the manufacturing centre for the country. I think what we've seen in the public's minds since the episodes in South Australia is a focus that their number one priority is the stability of the system. You don't want to be in a situation, as some of the big energy users in South Australia found themselves, like Arrium at Whyalla, or like BlueScope Steel at Olympic Dam, or the Port Pirie, Nearstar's Port Pirie lead smelter, where they suddenly lost power for operations that are 24/7. costing themselves millions and millions of dollars. When the smelter hardens up, you know, you stop all operations, and it has massive consequences. So I think people have seen what's happened in South Australia, and it's made them focus on stability, and that's where the government's message, I think, is getting a lot of traction. In terms of the hip pocket, I do think people, by and large, have a positive view of renewables, but they are starting to understand that it's not a linear transition from 10% renewables. Today we have 15%, so 15% renewables today to 50% by 2030. It just doesn't happen easily and smoothly. You do need to have much better systems in place. In South Australia, they did a poll that found that 1 in 5 families were spending less on essential items because of the high electricity bills. So essentially less on grocery bills and other essential items. I've met with the smallest food manufacturers to, you know, the biggest wine producers to wool processors to, you know, other small businesses. It's affecting everybody, and it's crushing them. And, you know, from an irrigator or from a, you know, for example, I went to a seafood business that exports to China crayfish. They have $1 million worth of product in their water tanks at any one time. These crayfish won't survive more than 30 minutes without the pumps working. So they've had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on backup generators just to ensure the stability of their business. This is not a cost that they should have incurred. So I think, to answer your question, the rubber has hit the road there in South Australia. The higher electricity prices around the country are starting to be felt now with the announced closure of Hazelwood. And I have felt that the sentiment has changed to the point that, yes, people want us to meet our emissions target, and yes, people want more renewables. By the way, they've put them on their roofs. We have the highest penetration in the world of solar PV anywhere in the world, largely, you know, supported by generous feed-in tariffs and subsidies. But people like renewables, but they won't do that at the expense of their energy security and affordability.
Hi. My father was a pioneer in setting up power stations, and both he and I were amazed why it is not a federal responsibility, just as banking was taken over and the railways. I really object to a left-leaning Labor government making decisions that affect the security of everybody. My electricity bills have tripled. Now, why can you not, on the grounds of interstate responsibility, take over the entire electricity market?
Well, as they said in the movies, it's the vibe. It's in the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't specify it's a Commonwealth responsibility. So that means that it falls effectively to the states. Now, the states have historically owned the generation, the distribution, the retail and the transmission assets. Here in New South Wales, you still own some of those assets. Large parts of the country, they've been sold. States can set their own renewable energy targets, and I've been very critical of the 50% renewable energy target that the Wetherill government set in South Australia, the 50%, bizarrely, the 50% renewable energy target the Palaszczuk government has set in Queensland, even though they get less than 5% of their power from renewables today, and the 40% renewable energy target Daniel Andrews in Victoria has established. The other point about the energy equation is that the states own the resources under the ground, namely the gas. And we've seen these moratoriums and bans on unconventional and conventional gas extraction. Here in New South Wales, only about 8.5% of your land is now available for unconventional gas exploration, where previously it was 60%. This is all putting pressure on the amount of baseload power we can get into the system, and it's a complex question. I can elaborate further, but the states have a lot of the levers. Now, under the COAG Energy Council, I chair it, but it's one vote for the Commonwealth and one vote for each of the states. So I don't think there would be an easy solution for a Commonwealth takeover, But what we do need is better coordination. And just one positive note to mention, which is on this on these renewable state targets, we've actually started to get somewhere. Because you may have noticed that the coalition oppositions in Victoria, South Australia and Queensland have all said we're not going to have a state-based renewable energy target like the Labor government's. Here in New South Wales, the coalition government just adopts the federal target, so it doesn't have a high state-based target. And now the Labor opposition in Western Australia, in the midst of their election, is running scared on this issue and has announced that there will be no state renewable energy target under a government that Mark McGowan leads. I've heard that formula before. But that's what he said. So you've got Labor state governments, oppositions, coalition oppositions, and a coalition government here who are not going down that path of Queensland, South Australia and Victoria.
There's a question here. Yes.
Thank you, Minister, for that massive statistical data. The really critical thing, it seems, for energy for Australia is in actual fact baseload energy. And what I would like to suggest, or perhaps you may have this information, which would be of great interest to the public, is that there are something like 24 coal-fired power stations in Australia. There's about 9 which are in the wings. What it would be very useful to see is the life cycle of these power stations and when they're about to close, and to put alongside that as a factor showing that there's improvement in our supply is what is coming on stream from the point of view of renewables. Now, unless...
Okay, can't go on.
Yes, sir.
Are you finished?
Yes, what we'd like to really see is a comparison of what is happening.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
Look, it's a good point. Government is focused on that level of information because we obviously have to prepare for these eventualities. But the biggest coal-fired power station to close will be Hazelwood. I mean, when you take out 22% of the supply in Victoria for a state that feeds into New South Wales and South Australia and Tasmania, it's going to have a significant impact. Obviously, renewable generation is coming on, to your point, but the challenges with renewable generation is what I've alluded to tonight, which is the supply is unpredictable and the battery storage technology is not there either in the quantity or in the quality to actually give you an equivalent to gas or to coal or to hydro. And so our point as a government is we're not saying that renewables are not part of the future. They very much are. Indeed, we're encouraging it with our own state-based target. But we're saying don't move ahead of the technology. Don't let your states get into a position where you're not prepared for what has happened in South Australia. It's about risk management. It's about engineering. And it's about prudence. And so far, we haven't seen that. And that's the sort of cultural change that we're seeking to drive. And if we can get more gas into the economy, into the equation, I think that will make a big difference.
Dimitri.
Minister, thank you. Just a threshold question. Your comments were peppered with observations about decarbonisation and carbon. Yeah, Australia accounts for around 1.3% of global emissions, a ratio that will probably decline with the rise of China, India and Africa. Why is carbon at all a policy consideration for the Australian government?
So the point is, we have to do our bit. And the Paris Agreement was signed on by 190 countries. It's been ratified by more than 100 countries. And you're right, we're 1.3% of the world emissions. The United States is 16%, China is 22%. If a country like Australia is not doing its bit, how can you expect a bigger country to then come on board and expect them to curb emissions? You either take the issue of climate change seriously, which we do, accept the science and strive to reduce our carbon footprint, or you don't. And so our task is how do we reduce emissions, meet our targets, which I've indicated tonight that we're actually on track to do, but without taking policies like a 50% renewable energy target, or like the forced closure of coal-fired power stations, which will actually put that stability of the system in jeopardy. And that's where the issue is currently playing out.
Question then.
Thank you, Mr. Freedom. My name is Leonard Young. Welcome again to Sydney. My question is with regard to the green bank that the government is proposing to set up. How do you ensure that this particular bank will always pick winners? Because you already have a future fund, and there are a lot of experts, you know, who look after the investments. So that my question is, how do you make sure that, you know, the winners are always picked?
I assume you're referring to the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which is an existing legislated institution with $10 billion in it. It's a loan program as opposed to a grant program. So there's ARENA, which is funding early stage R&D. That's a grant, largely focuses, for example, on universities and the like. And then there's the CEFC, which is a loan program where the money has to be paid back. Recent speculation has been about the mandate of that organisation and the type of technologies that it could invest in. Because under the legislation, it's prohibited investing in carbon capture and storage and in nuclear power. And I referred today to the importance of carbon capture and storage, according to the IPCC and the IEA, in meeting our emissions reduction targets. So these are all issues that the government has under consideration. But to date, those investments have been in a whole range of renewable energy technologies, like large-scale solar power. And it has to be said that the price of renewables per megawatt of power generated has come down substantially in recent years. So, for example, solar PV has come down about 80% in price over the last 7 years, and wind power has come down about 50% in price over the last 7 years. Battery technology is halving in price about every 5 years. So there are real improvements that are occurring in that area, but it's just, and we're helping to progress that, but it's just about balancing the system and its needs as it currently stands.
Minister, thanks very much for the update on policy and market developments. And I noted you made frequent reference to the chief scientist and his involvement with your review. My question is, why isn't the government considering more seriously his proposal for emissions intensity scheme, given its market-based, would reduce emissions and deliver low emissions at a lower cost than any alternative, including the status quo?
Well, he's actually been verbal in that regard because he never suggested an emissions intensity scheme. What his preliminary report did was it referenced an Australian Energy Market Commission report which looked at three different alternatives. It looked at extending the renewable energy target, it looked at the forced closure of coal-fired power stations, and it looked at an emissions intensity scheme. It just looked at those three, didn't look at other alternatives as a means of meeting Paris commitments. So he just referenced that as opposed to endorsing it. Ironically, that policy was described by the then climate change minister, now the leader of the opposition in the Senate, as a mongrel of a policy. It's become the Labor Party's policy. It's not one that this government is adopting. And we are conducting our climate change review at the moment, the Finkel review, and we'll allow those processes to run out, but we're not going down the path of an EIS.
Are we getting close to the end? We've got a question. It's got to be brief, yeah. And we've got one here.
Follow up on the Finkel review. The head of BlueScope Steel announcing good results this morning. A real turnaround, very interesting. And that said the energy situation in the country is catastrophic and very, very damaging for industry. Now, you've got a great grip on all the facts. Why is the Finkel review taking so long? If Australia was a business, it would have been completed by now. And yet Dr. Finkel seems to be wandering around the world, going to places like Arm to study what's going on there? Is that really necessary? Shouldn't the report be delivered quicker and the decisions made more quickly?
Well, a couple of ways to answer that. The first thing is about BlueScope deal. In fact, I met with the CEO on Friday and referenced that meeting in my interview on Sunday on the Insiders. And BlueScope is Australia's largest manufacturer, 7,000 workers, exports to more than 20 different countries, and obviously has a high energy bill. And he just brought home to me the urgency of this situation, both on the stability side and the affordability side. And he's not the first. I mean, like I said, I meet with food manufacturers and other key players, plastics producers, glass manufacturers, all the like. And it's important for all of them. So this is why we have to get it right, and this is why we can't afford to be ideological, and this is why we have to be everything. If anything, we have to be practical. On the issue of Alan Finkel, well, they're doing a mountain of work and we have to get it right. He's got an expert panel and their report was quite considerable, the preliminary report presented to COAG, which they did quickly and effectively. And they've already provided some recommendations to our COAG Energy Council, which we're now implementing. So, for example, we're working with the Australian Energy Market Operator to ensure that in South Australia now, you have two thermal generators, that is gas, on at any one time. Previously only needed one. The more of that baseload power you have, the more stable the system will be. The other thing we're doing is getting a much better understanding of the what are called the settings on the wind farms, because when they had the blackout last September, the settings on the wind farms were set in such a way that when the storms hit, they couldn't ride through the voltage disturbances such as the thermal generators could, and this led to a surge across the grid, and that's partly why the interconnector went down. So Finkel is helping us do all those things. I'm very pleased with the work he's doing today. We want him to get it right, but he's feeding suggestions in all the time that we're looking to implement, and we are.
Found a quick question, yeah.
Rod Henderson. Minister, you certainly do have some challenges, federal and state powers and divergent governments around the country, as well as the community. Everyone has a view in this space, it seems. But if you really want to get a bang for your buck, it does seem that, you know, in terms of baseload supply, baseload coal generation, using the state-of-the-art, highly efficient coal power stations, which are very successful in Japan, for example, what is the pathway to actually achieve that in within this current term? I mean, in terms of your own goals, and how do we get to that stage, including the community expectation? In terms of when your term, this current term of Parliament, is there an approval of a coal power station, a new one in New South Wales, for example? Do you see a pathway?
Well, these are all issues that we are working through, because you've got to have state approvals. You've got to have an industry partner or participant, and obviously, you know, the federal government has to play a role too. So these are not easily answered questions. So what we are saying in relation to these Healy plants is that we're looking at them very seriously. There's a lot of work that's been done behind the scenes, and if you look at international experience, they have worked, they are working, they've been increasingly rolled out. And we would be letting down the public if we didn't seriously investigate all these options in a technologically neutral way. And the urgency of the situation is real, and that is why we've already made some changes and will continue to make others. But I think you've already seen, to finish on this note, I think you've already seen in the last couple of weeks a significant change in public sentiment, but also in the political debate. And people ask me, well, Josh, can't we get bipartisanship on this? And I say, well, I'd love to get bipartisanship on this. In fact, we had a legislated renewable energy target through the Parliament 18 months ago, which the Labor Party said would restore investor confidence. Suddenly, Bill Shorten got hijacked by the left wing of his party and came up with his 50% target. So, you know, politics is a battle of ideas, and we'll call out a bad idea when we see it. And that's why we're not prepared to get on board, simply because the Labor Party is putting forward their notion of what is good policy. And so that's the task ahead of us. It's a big and a complex one, but we're determined to see it through. So thank you very much.
Thanks to Josh Frydenberg. It's great to have a cabinet minister along here today talking on so serious a problem. And I think it's true to say that of all the politicians in Australia, the minister has led the debate about the concern about reliability of supply, which wasn't much talked about even probably 3 or 4 months ago, and is now on the front page of the Australian every other day because it's such an important issue. So I'll be very brief tonight, just say once again thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for this facility, thanks for coming along and your questions, and thanks to the Minister for a very important address on a very significant topic. Well done, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.